clues here. Matthew is not a messenger. He has nothing to do with my past. He's just another patient with problems all his own. I pull myself from the wall, brushing the stray snow from my coat with trembling hands. And when I look up, I see them. My eyes land directly on them, nestled around the back of the house, as real and as solid and immutable as the building and the trees and the sky. Gates. A brand new entranceway in from the road, sealed with wrought iron electric gates. The ground seems to pull away beneath me like a wave beneath a ship. Chapter 40. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 13. Enemy at the gates. I try to call the hospital on my way. One hand on the wheel, one on the phone, but the signal is patchy and the automated hospital phone system transfers me from one department hold tone to the next. I try to stay calm. I try to think of a logical explanation to why and how Matthew could have known about those gates. How could he have known unless he had been there? When had he been there? Had he been there before his accident, or had he somehow managed to leave the hospital since? Was the sleeping bag I found in the woods this morning his? Has he been leaving the hospital at night? But that's not possible, surely. How could he have left the hospital without anyone noticing? I think of the crowds outside, the security guards, the press, Rhoda. He'd have to be some kind of genius to get past all that. But then I remember how he saved me yesterday, the bullet he took for me, the military arriving, and the idea of him sneaking out of his ward doesn't seem quite so crazy. I scroll through my mobile as I drive. I have 3 missed calls from Peter, which I really can't deal with right now. I find Nick Dunning's personal number in my contacts and tap. I have no idea what I'll say when he answers, but I need to know if Matthew is still there in the hospital, because I have a sinking feeling that he isn't. Nick's mobile goes straight to voicemail, and not knowing exactly how to frame a message, I hang up without leaving one. What would I say? My patient has been to my childhood home. Somehow. How would I explain that I knew from the start he knew my real name? I scroll to Chris's number, my thumb hovering over it. But again, what would I tell him? That I followed my patient's advice instead of his? That I thought everything that was happening here was to do with me, when there was clearly something else going on? No, I toss my phone into my bag and focus on the road ahead. When I get to the hospital, I pull up around the back and head straight to the second floor. Rhoda and another nurse look up as I run into the ward, trying to assess the situation. Rhoda frowns as I fly past. An elderly patient reaches out to touch my arm as I slip by the nurse's station, but I pull away with a quick apology and keep moving. Matthew's bed is empty and made. Everything is as it should be, but no Matthew. I toss my bag onto his bed and run back to the nurse's station. Rhoda, have you seen him anywhere? I pant. Matthew. He was here a minute ago. He's probably outside in the sunshine. Outside? Surely she can't mean out the front with the press. And then I remember the hospital garden. I turn so fast my shoes squeak on the floor. I burst outside into the cold sunlit snow, disturbing a group of relatives sitting with a bundled up patient. Try not to look crazy, Em. Try not to look like you've just lost your only patient, even if you have somehow managed to do just that. I scan the garden. It's just me and them. No Matthew. The family group stares at me. I'm sure they recognize me from the TV news, the doctor on the TV. I manage to muster what I hope constitutes a reassuring smile and aim it at them while my mind reels. Where is he? And who the hell is he? It must have been him in the woods watching me, but why? He had so many chances to hurt me. Hell, he even saved my life yesterday. What is he up to? And that's when I feel it, behind me, a gentle tug on the elbow of my jacket. I turn, thoughts still whirring, and look down to see a little old man gently tugging my sleeve. It's the old man who tried to get my attention at the nurse's station a moment ago. Now that I look at him properly, it's clear he isn't a patient. No slippers, no wristband, and wearing outdoor civilian clothes. He peers up at me questioningly, his white hair balding on top, his pink scalp shining through from underneath. "Excuse me," he says. "Yes? Sorry to bother you, Dr. Lewis. I see you're busy." His voice is friendly with a local lilt, but could you tell me where I could find Stephen? "Stephen?" I repeat, confused. "Oh yes, sorry. No one seems to know what I'm talking about today. Must have put my teeth in funny," he chuckles. "Yes, Stephen, tall chap, dark hair, easy on the eye." He smiles jovially. I saw the local paper yesterday on the bus and, well, I usually get my news from the radio, but when I saw the paper, I happened to see Stephen looking out at me. Hadn't seen him for a couple of weeks. Thought I'd come and say hello." He peers up at me hopefully. I feel a cold dread rising inside me. Tall, dark hair, easy on the eye. A million questions crowd out any single utterance. I gawp at him, dumbfounded, like a complete fucking moron. "'Cause you're his doctor, aren't you, dear? What's your name, please?" I ask carefully. Nigel. Nigel Wilton." "And who is Stephen to you, Mr. Wilton?" I try to quell the tsunami of panic rising inside me. "I suppose I was kind of a beau of his late mother, Lillian." Nigel blinks at me with a mixture of mild confusion and bashfulness. "I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm following you, Mr. Wilton." "Well, Stephen had been living in London before his mother got ill, and then he came back up here when she moved into the care home before she died last year. I met him a few times, very private, very quiet. He was sorting out her things afterwards, setting everything in order. I think the loss hit him hard. I was quite worried about him. I confess I did try and stop at the house the last few weeks, but I never did see him and the house was locked up. I thought he'd gone back to London and then, bam, I see his face all over the free paper on the bus." I sink down into the seat by the garden door. "Matthew is Stephen. Oh, shit. Shit, shit, shit." The old man bends to cup my hand in his. His kind, wrinkled face worried. "Is everything all right, dear?" I feel a wave of nausea crest inside me so violently that I have to dip my head between my legs until it passes. I have a vague awareness of Nigel rubbing my shoulder, murmuring something comforting. Finally, I look up into his eyes. "Mr. Wilton, what is Stephen's surname?" That's a tricky one. Now, his mother's surname was Merriman, Lillian Merriman, but when he started doing his acting, he changed it, I think, to McNab. Yes, that was it, McNab, I'm sure of it. He told me why he changed it, but I forgot. Personally, I think he just fancied the sound of it, got more of a ring to it. Nigel keeps talking, but I'm no longer listening. An actor. Oh, holy fuck. Matthew is an actor. And apparently not one that anyone in the country recognises. The story slams together in my mind. A lonely, unemployed man tries to take his life after his mother dies. Something went wrong, and he was found wandering by the police. He's been lying since the beginning. No, wait, he can't have been lying. I scanned him. I verified a fugue. His memory must have started coming back after the fMRI. After the last panic attack. And he kept it to himself. Perhaps that's what he wanted to tell me on the beach. Perhaps he wanted just a little bit longer playing Matthew. I suppose here, with us, he wasn't alone anymore. He just didn't want all this to end. He's been faking. How could I have been so incredibly wrong about this? My life pasted across the headlines, my career hanging by a thread for this. For a malingering actor. Did he try to tell me who he really was? Was I just not listening? I rise without a word and stride away from poor Mr. Wilton mid-sentence. Regardless of the whys and the self-blame and everything that will come after, I know with pure clarity that I need to find Matthew as soon as I can. When I get back to his empty room, I shut the door securely behind me, draw the curtain in the door's window. I search his room, tearing it apart, Emptying his locker, riffling through his few spare clothes, I strip his bed, pulling pillows from pillowcases and sheets from the mattress. And that's when I find it, nestled underneath the mattress up by the headboard. An iPhone in a dirty plastic Ziploc bag. I rip it out and scroll through its history. Searches. Oh my God. Searches on Stephen McNabb. Searches on Stephen Merriman. Notes in the note app titled Stephen. An address I don't recognise in Norfolk and directions to it. A note headed Dr. Emma Lewis. Beneath it, a link to an article I wrote on fMRI testing years ago. The times I arrived at the hospital. The times I leave. My old home address. He was there. He saw those gates. I think of his face yesterday when I joked about not having gates and remember how concerned he looked by my joke. He knew he'd made a mistake. He knew he wouldn't have long until I figured out, if the MOD hadn't worked it out already. He knew he'd have to go back to being Stephen, and then all of this would stop. The notes on me say nothing more. Nothing about my past. Nothing about the location of Cuckoo Lodge. It can't have been him in the woods. How would he have known where to find me? I pause. And how did he know the things he knew about me, about my past? There are no notes on that. No notes on Rhoda. How would he have known that my house had been filled with gas? I scour the phone's history for some mention of it, but there is nothing there. Nothing about Marnie. Nothing about Rhoda. How could he possibly know those things about us without looking them up? And last week, my identity wasn't something you could exactly Google. I need to find him. I find the last search in the phone's history. It tells me exactly where he's gone. It's Google Maps, directions from the hospital to a location. But why would he go there? I stare at the screen, confused, and slowly the truth of what Stephen is doing clicks into place. Oh no. No, no, no. He knows he's been found out and he's going to finish what he started. 2 weeks ago, Stephen Merriman tried to commit suicide and failed, and today he's heading back to the same spot. He doesn't want to be Stephen. He doesn't want to go back to that life. I understand his thinking. Once the press get hold of this information, Stephen's life will be plastered across the internet for all to judge. If his life wasn't hard already, it will be unbearable once his identity breaks. I have to stop him from doing what I think he might be doing. I pocket his phone and run. I burst out of the security door at the back of the hospital and into the car park, colliding with Rhoda coming the other way. Her hands fly to her chest with surprise, but I barely slow to register her before sprinting on towards my rental car. I fish around desperately in my bag for my car keys, but I can't seem to find them anywhere. Frantically, I tip the entire contents of my bag out onto the tarmac. "Everything okay?" Rhoda asks, crouching to help me scoop up the contents of my bag. "Graceford was looking for you. She's gone to the garden." Shit, Graceford. I don't have time for that right now. The last thing the situation needs is a uniformed police officer. "Someone's taken my car keys," I blurt instead. "I left my bag in Matthew's room and now my keys are gone." I realise I must look insane to her, scrambling around on the floor, sifting through my worldly possessions. 2 more missed calls from Peter on my mobile. "Oh, fuck, I literally just had them," I mutter. "Either someone took them or I must have dropped them or put them down somewhere." "Did you find Matthew?" She frowns down at me, confused. I'm not really listening. I'm scanning the car park for something heavy. I remember what the man at the car rental company said. There's a spare key inside the car manual folder in the glove box, passenger side. I see what I'm looking for over by the wall, next to the clinical waste bins. That'll do it. I race over to it. Because I can't find him anywhere. I looked in the garden and he's not on the ward or out here. Should I call security? Rhoda calls over to me, her tone anxious. I heft the brick in my bandaged hand as I run back to the car. This should work. But then, I've never really done this before, so what would I know? "He's gone," I say, breathlessly pulling up opposite her, the car between us. She eyes the brick. "But I think I know where he'll be." I pull back my arm as Rhoda finally seems to put two and two together. "Wait," she shouts as I start to swing the brick forward. "What the hell are you doing, you crazy—" The car window flashes milky on impact, shattering to crumbs. My hand burns white hot as the sharp crumbles of glass rain over it, and I drop the brick. I use my elbow now to push in the crumbled glass that still holds. Once it's clear, I reach through the gap, pop open the glove box door, pull out the manual, and unearth the key. My hand is on fire. I flex my fingers and use my other hand to depress the spare door fob. The satisfying clunk of the central locking opening. We're in. I peer at Rhoda over the car roof. Rhoda, can you drive? She stares at me, open-mouthed. If the pain in my hand weren't so bad, I might find her expression quite funny. Rhoda, can you drive? I say louder, shouting now. She seems to recover and her focus clicks in. She may not have been her best self in a crisis yesterday, but I almost see her make the decision that she damn well will be today. Yes, I can drive, she answers. She yanks open the unlocked driver's door and slides in. I brush the glass crumbs from the passenger seat with the sleeve of my coat as I dive in next to her, slamming the door behind me. I push the ignition key into her outstretched palm and we lock eyes. Where to? She says, turning the engine over and slipping into first gear. The beach. Head out towards Holcomb, that's where he'll be. We need to get there fast, Rhoda, I say. She nods, and once we calmly clear the security barrier, she floors the accelerator, and we screech out onto the main road. Chapter 41. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 13. Back where we started. The car hares down the snowy country lanes, Rhoda's hands tightly gripping the wheel as we bend into the next turn. I pray that we don't hit a patch of ice. I've had time to think on the drive. I tried to call Chris, but outside of King's Lynn, the phone signal has dropped away, and I don't have the benefit of the lodge's Wi-Fi out here. The only way to get help is to find it in person or get somewhere with reception. But we don't have time for that. Up ahead, it comes into view. The lay-by, the path leading directly down to the beach. He'll be there. God, I hope he'll be there. My eyes shoot to Rhoda. Once you drop me, just go. I shout over the wind buffeting in through my broken window. Just go, okay? Get to somewhere with phone signal and call Chris Poole. I scramble into my bag for my wallet, fumble out the crumpled slip of paper with Chris's phone number and thrust it at her. Do you understand, Rhoda? Don't call the police, all right? Her eyes flash to me for a second as she shifts down into third gear, and then she quickly snatches the paper. She moistens her lips, eyes back on the road. Just Chris, I tell her again. Okay, whatever you do, don't call the police. If Stephen is there to take his own life, the sight of uniformed police showing up to potentially arrest him is not going to help me convince him that everything is going to be okay. I search Rhoda's face. She's weighing my request. She knows that the police might be exactly the people she should be calling. But her intuition will be telling her, too, that the police might cause more harm here than good. Police might escalate this far too quickly. Okay, she answers finally, out of time, as we crunch into the lay-by. No police, just Chris. Got it. Go. Go. I fly out of the car before it even stops moving, and I'm running, pounding across the lay-by shingle and onto the beach path, sand flying out behind me. My breath rasps high in my throat as I hear the whine of the rental car reversing behind me. She's going to get Chris to get help, because I'm not sure I can stop him by myself. The trail opens out onto the vast sweep of Holcomb Beach, the wind pummeling me as I head up the steep bank of the nearest dune. I need a good vantage point. I scramble to the top and catch my breath, gasping in air, a cramp spasm deep in my side. I scan the horizon. A black speck in the distance. Hard to see at first. The tide is out, and he's walked out across the wet sand to meet it. If he gets in the water at this temperature, he won't last long before he slips under. That must be his plan, his original plan. I bound down the shifting slope and race across the endless flat stretch of the beach. 100 yards from him, I slow my pace, my breath heaving in and out of me. He's not wearing shoes, he's taken them off. No coat either. Matthew! I yell over the wind. Either he doesn't hear me or he doesn't want to. I try again, louder, as I jog towards him, but he doesn't turn. I try something else. Stephen! He stops in his tracks. I stop now too. There's 50 yards between us. and I watch, panting, as he turns to face me. He holds my gaze exposed for a long moment. His eyes full of so much apology, so much vulnerability, so much understanding. And then with a sad smile, he shrugs, not carelessly, but as a kind of explanation. Something about it is so touching, my heart yawns wide open in my chest. His borrowed clothes, his borrowed life, his cold bare feet, and the fact that no one even missed Stephen. Almost 2 weeks on the front page of every national paper, on the news daily, and only doddery old Nigel Wilton recognised him. Stephen has no one. But Matthew had everyone. It was a no-brainer. He watches me as I approach him again, and when I'm close enough, he opens his mouth to speak. "It was the gates, wasn't it?" he calls over the howl of the wind. I nod. "And you had a visitor today." He frowns, perplexed. "Nigel, a friend of your mother's?" His eyebrows shoot up, and he lets out a surprised laugh. "Ah, I see. Stephen, I'm sorry about what happened to you. About your loss." He nods mutely, eyes cast across the dunes in the distance. "I never meant for all of this, you know, Emma." "I know you didn't," I say, because we never do we, any of us? Sometimes we just start down a road and before we know it, things spiral out of control. People get hurt. We get hurt. "Will you come back with me, Stephen? To the hospital?" He looks past me, back towards the forest, considering his options. "Is it just you here, Emma?" "Yes, I got someone to drop me. They went back to get help. I wasn't sure what I would find when I got here." I catch a flicker of something behind his eyes and quickly add, "But I can tell them not to come. We can get somewhere with signal, then we can just sort this all out together," I continue. "Just you and me, I promise." But that's a lie. We both know it. We can't sort this out together. Because now I know who he is. I know, and I will have to tell other people, and those people will tell other people, and then the whole world will know that he lied. So no, this can't all be sorted out between us. He knows the game has ended, unless I decide to try and keep it going. He studies me for a long moment, weighing his options. "I've been trying to get you on your own for so long now," he says, his eyes warm with feeling. "I wanted you to know. I wanted to tell you, just you. I thought if I could explain everything to you, maybe you'd understand. But there were always other people just around the corner. I wanted to be your Matthew so much. Come back with me and we can talk, Stephen, I promise you. Just us." "I don't think so, Emma," he shakes his head. "I think I'll stay here. But thank you. And I'm sorry, you know. Sorry for everything that's happened to you because of me. For putting my career in danger, my life." He waits for a moment, eyes cast into the distance beyond me, as he gives a final nod and turns back towards the sea. "Stephen, you don't have to do this," I shout after him. He turns back suddenly, the floodgates seeming to burst within him as words pour violently from him, vibrating with emotion. "I do. All my life, Emma, all my life, I've been invisible. I thought if I left here, if I went somewhere new, to London, if I started a new life, a new job, things would change. I'd live this amazing life out there in the world. I'd have these brilliant friends and be part of something bigger, something important. I'd connect, I'd create, tell stories. But it didn't happen that way. It just didn't. It's lonely out there and people aren't often kind. They're just as broken and as cruel as us. I wasted years of my life. And on what? Chasing some notion, some dream. And meanwhile, the only person I ever really had died. The only real connection I had." He frowns. "She'd forgotten everything by the time I made it back up here. My mother. I kept putting it off. I knew she was getting worse and I waited too long. She'd forgotten me. She'd forgotten she even had a son. I don't think people can understand how much that hurts. The only real connection you have just evaporating. I could have gone back to London after the funeral. Back to my own life, back to my one-bed flat and my shitty part-time job, but why? There's nothing there for me. I could have gone back and hoped for the best, hoped that someday, what, that I'd meet somebody. Somebody who really sees me, who really cares, who can get past the surface. Do you know how hard that is? The statistical likelihood of that happening. And the lonelier you get, the harder it is to hide it. It festers inside you like a wound you can't conceal. People sense it. They sense it more the harder you try and hide it. And I'm tired of hiding it. I'm tired of waking up every morning to a future I can't quite see. So in answer to your question, yes, Emma. Yes, I do have to do this, because I don't want to go back to the way things were, and I certainly don't want to go back to worse. I would have given anything to be Matthew, and I can't be Stephen anymore. His words hang in the air, his chest heaving from the storm of words. His eyes scan the pine forest behind me, lost, because what more can he say, really? I understand, more than he can ever know. And what he says is true. Things will be worse after this, for both of us. He might face criminal charges for wasting police time, fraud. He might spend the rest of his life in and out of mental health facilities. The press will come down hard on him for wasting NHS funds, lying to the public, and the most cardinal of sins, tricking them. It will be hard for him to put his life back together, to find the connection he so craves. But then, some people never do. I know I haven't. I wish there was something I could do to fix this. I was so wrapped up in my own life that I didn't see what was happening right in front of me. I let him down. The guilt is overwhelming, and as I stand here, caught in the amber of the moment, the wind whipping my hair across my face, I remember the words we learnt at school. We didn't recite the Hippocratic Oath during training, or swear it, but we learnt a modern version of its tenets. The health and well-being of my patient will be my first consideration. I will respect the autonomy and dignity of my patient. I will respect the secrets that are confided in me, even after the patient has died. The secrets. I watch him turn away from me, defeated. I can't let him kill himself, and I don't want to make his life worse. Do no harm. Because who has he harmed in all of this, really? What would be gained by making Matthew be Stephen? I will respect the secrets that are confided in me. Perhaps we can let Stephen disappear, and Matthew can just take his place. Matthew! I call out now, loud over the wind. There's another option, I shout. If you'll just trust me, there is another option. And I say it with such surety, I almost convince myself. Chapter 42. The Man. Day 13. Best Laid Plans. She explains her plan to me as we walk back towards the car. She doesn't ask how I got here, but as we round the path back to the car park, the question answers itself. It's Rhoda's, I say, as she throws me a look, her forehead creased with concern. She doesn't know I took it, I clarify. I didn't ask. I'm not surprised at her concern, because her plan is risky, very risky. But I always knew she'd help me. That she'd be this way. Brave. Strong. That's why I chose her. Because she'd tried to help, no matter what the cost to herself. I wish in a way I'd found her years ago. Things might have been different. They might have been. They might be yet. Her plan is simple. I'm going to disappear. Her patient, Matthew, will disappear. She'll pretend she never found me on the beach today. She'll pretend she never heard the name Stephen McNabb. She'll keep my secret, and I can just disappear. All I have to do is promise I won't hurt myself. She wants me to take her to my mother's house. She wants to make sure I have everything I need in order to leave, money, documents. She's not sure yet she can trust me not to hurt myself the moment she turns her back. It's reassuring, but she couldn't be further from the truth. I like her. For all her damage, there's a clarity to her, a courage. I knew there would be. I knew she'd understand. I pull Rhoda's car into the drive of a little wood-framed seafront house, the house that belonged to the late Lillian Merriman. A compact, well-tended garden, lace curtains hanging in the well-proportioned windows, sun-faded paint peeling off the woodwork. Quaint. Homely. I lead Emma up the path and stop at the front door, reaching overhead to lift a key from inside a hanging basket. My elbow brushes against her hair as I do, and she moves aside for me, her cheeks flushed. I slide the key into the lock. It's dim inside, the curtains drawn. I flick on the lights, and a warm glow floods the open-plan space. Bohemian and dishevelled, stacks of magazines, piles of books, old photographs pinned directly into the wood of the walls. A treasure trove of curios, antique low furniture, all slightly faded, slightly broken down. I watch Emma's face as she drinks it all in. A glimpse into a history, a life. If there's one thing to be said about Lillian, it's that she had great taste. And somehow the ferns and potted plants that litter the room have stayed alive, despite not being watered for weeks. Their fronds still plump and green, in the chink of daylight peeking through the curtained French doors. She pulls their fabric back, and winter sunlight floods the room from the beach beyond the glass. She peers out at the waves, the bank of snow-sprinkled dunes. We're only a 20-minute walk from where I was found. "It's beautiful," she remarks, the light from outside throwing her features into relief. "It is," I agree as she turns back to me. "Will you miss it?" she asks. I look around the lived-in room. It's been good to me. Some of it, I suppose. She studies my face, wondering at what thoughts might be buzzing around beneath. I wonder what she sees. "I suppose I should get my things together then," I say, breaking the tension. "That's what we agreed. I'll gather enough clothes to last a few days. I'll gather Stephen McNabb's passport, driving license, wallet, and other information, and then I'll disappear. I'll take Rhoda's car and dump it somewhere along the way. Matthew will simply vanish, and I'll go on to live the rest of my life somewhere else. It's a nice idea." She nods, and I head through the doorway into the connecting bedroom, leaving her to look around. I know it won't be long until she notices, so I sit down on the edge of the bed and wait. My hands quiver as I look at them. So much rides on what happens next. I look up at the bedroom wall in front of me. Research. Months of work. Months of planning. News clippings, plans, logistics to get Emma here alone now. Not that I can remember doing most of it. A small article has fallen to the floor. A clipping about an Afro-Caribbean nurse attacked in a park. I stand and pin it back up next to the photo of Rhoda on the board. Alongside it, old articles on Marnie Beaufort. The Charles Beaufort Inquiry. 16-year-old Marnie in paparazzi photos, her fingers bandaged on her left hand. In the beginning, I'd only been looking into Dr. Emma Lewis. It's her I need. But Dr. Lewis's history only went back so far. But I had resources, so I dug deeper. I've got good at that over the years. And in Dr. Lewis's past, I found Marnie Beaufort, with her burnt fingers and her dead dad. I scan the wall, my wall. So many faces. Faces from the hospital, snippets of their lives, little memories stored deep inside my mind. The first time I saw this wall, after the phone brought me here 3 days ago, I studied it and things started to come together. I realized how I knew half of what I knew. my research, clues I'd left myself, the extent of what I might have done, wakening inside me. I listened to her out there, the soft shuffle of her feet, the plump of her turning over Lillian's old books. I relished these last few moments. It won't take long until she sees the photographs of Stephen on the wall. Stephen and his mother Lillian. Photographs of them gardening, of her visiting him in London, of his smiling face, similar to mine, but different. Very different, really. But I chose someone believable, it seems. I think I always do. Someone whose passport photo is close enough to me to be plausible. And no one really looks like their passport photo anyway, do they? We all lose a few pounds. We change our hair. We get older. The room next door has gone silent. She stopped moving out there. It must be happening. I go over to the doorway and watch her, her back to me as she peers at the photographs pinned on the wall, her hand gently resting on one in particular, a faded colour photo. Though her back is turned, I feel it happen. I feel the realisation slowly take her, sinking into every bone in her body. I feel the air in the house around us thicken. I feel her fear as she realises that the person in the house with her isn't who she thinks it is. She must feel my eyes on her because she straightens slowly and turns, trying so hard to keep calm, to stay in control, to not let the huge waves of panic sweeping through her engulf and drown her. She's already seen what I can do. She saw yesterday in the hospital. She knows there's no point in running. I give her my most reassuring smile. What else can I do? After all, I like her. I want her to feel safe. All of this is for her. She holds my gaze, her expression a careful mask. She's calculating her options. I would be too. I step into the room slowly. I don't want to spook her. She starts to speak, but the words catch. She clears her throat and tries again. You're not Stephen. No. She blinks. Who are you? I think for a second how best to answer. I don't know, I say, because that's the truth. If I knew, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't need her. She takes a moment to absorb this, then nods. And what happened to the real Stephen? I wonder for a moment if I should lie, if I should keep the terrible truth from her longer. But then I realise she can't help me if I keep lying. I'm not entirely sure yet, I say, very carefully, but I'm pretty certain I killed him. I drop the British accent now, too, letting myself slip back into my American vowel sounds. Her eyes flare, blazing at me from across the room. She swallows. She's terrified. I can't blame her. So was I when I remembered some of the things I've done. I need your help, Emma. Do you think you can help me? I say it tenderly. I want her to know she's safe with me, she's protected. Her eyes flash to the door and back to me. I don't want to hurt you, Emma, I promise. I just need your help. I just need you to listen to me, please. I need you to tell me how to fix this, how to fix my mind. Can we just talk? She moistens her bottom lip, eyes alive as she studies me intently. She seems to reach a conclusion, and her demeanor changes ever so slightly. She seems to settle back into the room, then nods her head decisively. Okay, let's do this. We can do this. Let's talk. She looks around the room, her eyes alighting on the two armchairs that face to look out at the sea beyond. She gestures over to them. Shall we? Chapter 43. Zara and Chris. Day 13. Time out. Zara's hair is scraped up tight into a messy bun, loose strands framing her face as she tries to keep her voice even. I know it was my idea, Chris, but I want you to come back. Chris is perched on the edge of their bed, his eyes fixed on the thick pile carpet they chose together 6 months ago. I was angry, Chris. Come on, you're no angel. You lied to me. You didn't tell me you knew her, who she was. I just find a text and I'm supposed to understand why you want to go for a secret drink with another woman. We don't keep secrets. Chris stays quiet. He hasn't told her what happened the night before last either. The kiss. That long, warm kiss, 15 years in the making. He can't tell Zara how he lights up when he sees Emma, how she lets him look after her, how she makes him feel needed, and how Zara doesn't. How he needs Zara more than she needs him, and no matter how long they've been together, he still feels closer to Emma. Say something, Chris, she prompts, her voice quiet, hopeful. Chris looks up at her, at his stuff littering the floor of their bedroom, at the honeymoon suitcase open next to him on the bed. Honey, if I told you who she was, you would have just written about it, wouldn't you? He says it almost tenderly because he reasons, though who's he to judge, he promised to love Zara forever. And he barely made a year. That's not fair, Chris. I might not be an angel, but don't pretend that's the reason you didn't tell me you invited her for a drink. Because you were worried I'd write a story about Charles Beaufort. I'm not an idiot. You asked her out for a drink because you wanted to spend time with her. You missed her, right? You liked her back then, didn't you? Did you guys go out? Did you sleep together back then? Chris looks at Zara's unmade-up face, her eyes red, her cheeks wet, but still so beautiful, and he feels a deep ache of guilt. Marnie and him didn't go out. He never asked her. He'd been too afraid he'd ruin their relationship, their closeness, that he'd scare her away. So no, they never slept together. And when Marnie left, after her father's death and everything that happened after, he thought about her a lot. He wrote her a letter, but hadn't known where to send it. He'd asked the school to pass it on, but they couldn't. So he got on with his life. He'd gone to university and fallen in love with the closest girl he could find that reminded him of Marnie. Thick brown hair, golden freckles, an infectious laugh. This was before he came back to Brancaster and got together with Zara for real. Perhaps it had been the way Marnie left, the gap she left behind in his life. But he thought about her a lot. Less and less over the years, but every now and then, and so strong. He didn't think he'd see her again. He wouldn't have made a promise if he'd known she'd come back. Chris knows he could tell Zara all of that, but why would he hurt her more? What good would it do to explain the reasons? And Zara shouldn't have done what she did. You're making this about me, Zay. What you did to her was bad. Really bad. It's like you don't think the things you do affect people. You broke into her house. You're so lucky she hasn't pursued this. Her hands and feet were bleeding, you know. And what you did about her identity, that was just cruel. Really cruel. It put her in direct. Chris's iPhone blares to life on the dresser on the other side of the room, its jaunty tune painfully at odds with the tone of their conversation. Chris makes a move towards it. Zara's eyes flare. Don't you dare answer that, Chris. Not right now. Chris squeezes his eyes shut and lets out a loud sigh. He sits back down on the bed as they wait, wordlessly, for the call to ring out. After the silence settles, Zara collects her thoughts. I was angry, Chris. I've apologized. I've said I'm sorry. There's no way I could have known what would happen yesterday. You know that. Litchfield was hardly my fault. I couldn't know someone would try and hurt her. You can't blame me for that. The phone bursts to life again, insistently. Oh, Jesus fucking Christ! Zara whips around, picking it up without checking the number. What? A voice on the other end, muffled, and Zara's hand flies up to her forehead. Sorry. Oh, God, sorry. Yes, yes, he is. Who is this? Okay, 1 second. She holds out the phone to Chris. It's a nurse from the hospital. Who? She didn't say her name. Seconds later, Chris bursts from the bedroom and bounds down the stairs, taking two at a time. "And have you called anyone else?" he asks. Chris frowns at Rhoda's reply, then asks, "Why would she say that?" At the base of the stairs, he shrugs on his uniform jacket and rattles his pocket for car keys as he listens to the answer. "Okay, listen, it doesn't matter. I'm on my way. No, you go back to the hospital if you're on duty. She said just me, right?" Zara appears at the top of the staircase. "Where are you going?" she mouths, her expression racked with guilt. Chris looks up at her and raises a hand. They'll pick up this conversation later. His attention is drawn back to the phone. "No, it's okay, don't worry. I'm on my way to Holcomb now," he says, turning away from his wife. "I'll be there as soon as I can." Chapter 44. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 13. Talk Therapy. We sink down into the two chairs opposite each other, and I steal a fleeting look to the front door. It's too far, and besides, even if I managed to make it out onto the road, I know he would catch me. I'd feel the weight of him crashing into me from behind, and that would be it. No, best not to run. I rest back into my chair, aware of the bulk of my mobile phone and pager in the depths of my coat pocket. The phone is right there, on silent. I could slip a hand down and get it. But then what? Pull it out and dial? Or just blindly tap at it in my pocket? I vaguely know there's a combination of buttons you're supposed to press to make a secret emergency call, but I have absolutely no idea which ones you're supposed to press. Why did I never find that out? I could try my luck anyway, but I'd only risk tipping the balance of the situation if he catches my hand tapping. I'd only be shortening any precious time I have left. I know I can't outrun him, so I need to outthink him. I need time. I need to work out who he is and what he wants with me. I watch him settle. He winces slightly as he leans his shoulder back into the chair, this man who isn't Matthew and isn't Stephen. I ask myself what I actually know about him. I know he knows things about me he couldn't know. He knew my name was Marnie as soon as he saw me. And I know he's killed. He's told me as much himself. In spite of everything that's happened, I still can't help but wonder if this does lead back to that night 14 years ago. Judging by his demeanour, I don't think he wants to kill me. He's had the opportunity to hurt me already and he hasn't. In fact, he's saved me before now. A faint glint of hope sparks inside me. I let my gaze connect unthreateningly with his. I've worked with dangerous people throughout my medical career. The trick is to understand that they are the most vulnerable. They need the most care. "What is it that you remember?" I ask gently, after some time passes. He looks away out of the French doors towards the sea. "Just pieces, really. Only fragments." I weigh his words, unwilling to be fooled again. There is a chance he's lying. But given the fMRI results only days ago, he should still only be dealing in fragments, as he says. "Tell me about these fragments," I prompt. "Is the memory of the forest one of them?" He glares back at me, caught off guard. "Yes," he returns. "The forest is one of them." Slowly his gaze softens and drops from me. "There was a girl," he continues, "in the forest. I was younger. I don't know when this was, what year or where. The memories are only images, sounds, feelings." He pauses, clearly working through the memory as he speaks. "They come in flashes, moments. A young girl with dark hair, the sound of her chasing me, breathing. I feel in the memory that I loved her, I cared for her. I can't remember her name or... She's running after me. She was so... She wanted to help me. She was so good. An image of her face, close to mine. She was crying when I don't remember why I did it. These horrible thoughts." He breaks off, his eyes glistening in the light from the French doors. I study this stranger's face, a face I thought I knew, a face I'd come to love in my own way. This man has Matthew's features, but someone else's voice. and the things he's saying Matthew would never say. He swipes away the wetness beneath his eyes with the sleeve of his good arm and looks back at me, searching for a reaction, a judgment, on his partial confession. But I'm used to hearing confessions. I'm used to being a receptacle for awful things. It's part of my job. I keep my face an impartial blank. No reproach, only my willingness to hear more. I remember it happening, Emma. I remember my hands around her neck, her eyes, the life fading, her pupils releasing impossibly wide, black, endless. He breaks off momentarily, lost in the memory, before snapping back to me. I remember it happening, but I don't remember me doing it. Does that make sense? I mean, I wouldn't do that, a thing like that. You have to believe me, I couldn't do a thing like that. It makes no sense. These memories I have, they aren't me. I can't have done those things. His voice sounds reedy, lost. He has no connection to these events, no personal identification with these actions. And for one insane microsecond, the idea that perhaps these awful memories truly aren't Matthew's at all flashes through my mind. The idea that somehow he could be part of the military, that these memories could somehow be someone else's, that he could be part of some kind of program. A neuroscience experiment, a study in memory manipulation, and that somehow Groves could be part of all of this. Stop it, M. My thoughts stutter to a halt, because, of course, that is not possible. Medically, none of that is possible. I so want there to be another explanation to this story. I so want this man to be good, that I'm seriously considering the existence of artificial memory implantation in test subjects. I'd actually rather consider science fiction than believe my patient is a bad person. That's how strong an effect Matthew has on people, consciously or not. That's how much I want him to just be Matthew, an innocent man wronged. But I know the human brain, what it can and can't do, and memories can't be implanted. Facts can be suggested to subjects, as in the shopping mall experiment, and memories can be embellished or reframed, but they can't be completely fabricated. Not in the way that would be necessary to explain the things Matthew is telling me. Whole life histories can't be manufactured, not by the military, not by anyone. Neuroscience just doesn't work like that. Only wishful thinking does. Matthew killed those people. Plain and simple. I try to focus, to distance my understanding of Matthew from the person now sitting in front of me. Do you think, Matthew, there's a chance you might have been involved in the military? His eyebrows rise at my use of the name Matthew. I realise I haven't said it out loud since the beach. But what else can I call him? He's definitely not Stephen, and I have nothing else to go on. He shakes his head. No, I wasn't in the army, but I think I might have, He rubs a hand over his tired eyes. Okay, I think it's... Please don't get scared, Emma, but I think one of the people I've been at some point was a soldier. I think I took a soldier's identity. He pauses, eyeing me warily. I pick people near my age, my build, people who look similar. I think maybe the military people who showed up yesterday thought I was that missing soldier. He will have disappeared. I might have been him for a while. Matthew took another man's identity. He killed a soldier. He killed Stephen. He picks people and then becomes them. He literally and figuratively takes their lives. Images from nature flash through my mind. Cuckoos, chameleons, hermit crabs, existential adaptive behaviour. In a sense, I suppose I'm safe. Matthew can't become me. But then again, that might not stop him from killing me. How did the military not pick up on any of this in their interview yesterday? But then perhaps they did. Maybe they had their suspicions but needed more time. How didn't I? It occurs to me that this may be the very reason Matthew has chosen now to show himself to me, before things start to slip, before we run out of time together. I can only hope Dr. Samuels picked up on something yesterday, sensed that something was wrong, and someone must have noticed I'm missing today. I remember Peter's missed calls, and I pray he raises the alarm. Do you think the military know who you really are, Matthew? I ask. He shakes his head thoughtfully. No, he says. There's a finality to it that makes my heart sink. They know I'm not him, the missing soldier, and that seemed to be enough. We just look similar. I think they have nagging doubts, but I'm not what they're looking for. Every now and then, forgetting things has its upside. He smiles ruefully. I didn't know the answers to any of their questions. I genuinely didn't recognize the soldier's name when they said it. It's strange how quick people are to make up their minds when faced with simple incomprehension. I'd rather not have what I have, but sometimes, it seems, it does take care of me. He fooled them. Well, not fooled exactly, but they certainly didn't find out the truth. The military don't know, the police don't know, and I'm guessing realistically Peter doesn't know. They'll work it out at some point, but will that be soon enough? Right now, no one knows what he's capable of, which means no one is coming for me. It's just Matthew and me until this ends, however it ends. I try to calm my panicked thoughts. As long as I'm his doctor and he's my patient, as long as I keep this symbiotic relationship active, then I'm safe. You said you'd rather not have what you have. What does that mean, Matthew? What do you think you have? I ask. This is why he needs me, and it might be my trump card. I don't know, but this isn't the first time all of this has happened to me. I know that. The memory loss, a reset in my brain. It's always been like this. I don't think my condition has ever been an exact science, even to me. Your condition? The fugue has happened before, I blurt out in spite of myself. He nods. It's happened periodically throughout my life. I never know when it will come, no warning. Sometimes I get years uninterrupted, sometimes only months. I used to have no control over it. One moment I'm living my life, and the next I wake up with nothing. I'll come to in an alley or a park or a beach, somewhere, doesn't matter where. I'll have nothing. And I'll have been robbed or attacked or whatever it is that time around, and I'll have no memory of how I got there or what came before. My mind's a blank. Then it resets, and slowly, day by day, piece by piece, it comes back. Tiny, triggered memories bring things crashing back. A face, a word, a sound, a feeling, and all the things I've learned about myself jumbled and cryptic. The facts, memories in no order. A mess of information, and I try to piece it together. Where my own memories and the lives of others collide, it becomes confusing. And then, of course, there are some memories that never come back. Like what? I ask, my interest piqued in spite of everything. You asked who I am. I don't know. I don't know who I was to begin with. I don't think I ever know. In any cycle of this, I don't think it ever comes back. But I can control the condition to a degree these days. Living like this, it's hard. But over time, I've developed coping mechanisms to deal with the resets. To some extent, I have strategies. A few years ago, I realized I could bring them on myself. I worked out I could leave myself memory prompts, small things, messages. That's what helps me these days. I found messages this time around. I have to leave a trail between cycles, like breadcrumbs, or it all goes. And I can't have that. I can't start from nothing all over again. I just can't. You can't imagine what that's like. No piece of grit to form yourself around. He holds my gaze with a steely intensity, and all his usual warmth is gone. I feel a shiver of dread fizz through me at what he's describing. tinged at its edges with excitement, because the symptoms he's outlining are a psychiatrist's dream. Somehow I've accidentally wandered into treating the most fascinating and dangerous patient of my career. Perhaps this is what I wanted. If I was a Jungian analyst, that'd certainly be my takeaway from all this. If I weren't so completely crippled by fear, I'd pull out my phone and record this. His symptoms, recurrent fugue, full dissociation from violent behaviour, coupled with remorse, shame, fear, it sounds like dissociative personality disorder. Dissociative personality disorder used to be called multiple personality disorder, or MPD. They renamed it in the 90s because there was this common misconception, even in the medical community, that MPD meant a patient had more than one personality. It doesn't mean that. It means that the patient has less than one personality. It is a fragmenting or a splintering of identity, shards of independent self. "When did this start, Matthew?" I ask carefully. "Do you remember how it started?" I encourage him. When I was young, a kid, as far back as that. But I don't remember my family, if that's where you're going with this. I don't know how it started. My best guess is I must have lost my family after one of the early resets. You can't go home if you don't remember where home is. So I lost them, or perhaps they lost me. He smiles sadly, and without thinking, I find myself smiling back in sympathy. Because whoever this man is, he has Matthew's face. He has Matthew's smile. "Either way," he continues, "I don't remember who they were." He shakes his head. "It's strange, you know. I don't think I've ever told another person these things." He's trying to elicit another personal response from me. He's testing the boundaries of our relationship. I weigh my options carefully before responding. "And how does that make you feel, Matthew?" He grins at my evasion, aware of my dilemma, of our dilemma. The doctor-patient contract is a simple one, but so easy to unbalance. He gives a nod of acknowledgement before answering my question. "It makes me feel good, Emma, so thank you for listening." Our boundaries successfully reset, I shift position in my chair and reorient the conversation. "Do you remember who you were before you woke up on the beach, Matthew?" I have flashes of him. I have flashes of being lots of different people, living lots of different lives. I don't know exactly who I was before I was Stephen. "You weren't actually Stephen, though, were you? You took Stephen's identity." He sobers at my correction. "Yes." "And you're certain you killed him? You remember that? There isn't the possibility you just stole his identity?" I say the words as neutrally as I can. I need to be his ally. He hesitates. The thought seems to be a new one for him. "I can't remember the physical act of killing him, no. But I must have, because here I am, being Stephen. And that's how I've always done it in the past." "How you've always done it? How many others have there been, Matthew?" He studies me, his still handsome face open and artless. "Quite a few, Emma," he says simply. "I remember some of them in detail, and yet it's like remembering a dream or a nightmare. What I'm doing seems to make sense at the time, but it doesn't in the remembering, do you see? At the time, it seems like the only choice, like a necessity. Do you understand? To get away, or because I need an identity. If I just stole an identity without killing the person, I would just be waiting for the day that the real person claimed it back. It happened in the early days. I need an identity to live, to rent a car, to book a flight, to get a job, to live a life. I need a face, a name, and I didn't have one." My thoughts go to the phone buried deep in my pocket. So close, but so incredibly far. I think of Rhoda sending Chris to the beach I'm no longer on, and I want to cry. I think of how Matthew has been trying to get me on my own for so long. He's thought of everything, and now I have no way out. How did you know my name when we met, Matthew? Why am I here? I ask, the words coming out almost involuntarily. I notice the slight tremble in my voice. He hears it too, and finally seems to realize that I'm terrified to my bones, terrified of the things he has said, terrified of this situation. Oh God, Emma, I'm so sorry. Please don't be scared. You must know that I would never hurt you. I promise that. You can't understand how... He stops and looks down. I notice his hands are trembling now too. You can't possibly understand what you mean to me. You are all I have. All of this is for you. Everything I have done is to find you, to get close to you. His brown eyes, warm once more, dart over my face, searching for understanding. All of this is for me? What does that mean? Why did he need to find me? I don't know him. Do I? Or have I just forgotten? I think about who has been in my life, who might try as hard as Matthew to find me. An old patient? Someone from my childhood? I know this can't have anything to do with my father, but I suddenly hear myself blurt out the question before I can stop myself. The question that's been on my mind ever since we met. Did someone send you to find me, Matthew? I don't care how crazy it sounds. We're well past crazy at this stage. He looks confused for a moment, so I continue. How did you know the things you knew about me, Matthew? My burnt fingers, the pilot light. Why did you say sorry for what you did the first night we spoke? You pretended to be my father. I don't understand why you would do that. Was it all a trick? The questions fire from me, questions I've kept stifled at the back of my mind for too long. I hear the bite in my voice, but I don't care anymore. And if it was a trick, then I am dying to know to what end. He seems taken aback, as if he assumed I knew the answers to these questions already. Though how I could have, I do not know. I see. I'm sorry, Emma. I haven't explained this well. It must be confusing. Let me go back to the beginning. When I woke up on the beach, I had a name on my hand. Marn. The I in Marnie must have washed away. Not that it mattered. A memory came back to me. I knew I had to find a woman, but I didn't know who. I guess the name would be important. She wasn't at the hospital, and I didn't know how I'd find her until you arrived. Then I finally saw you, and I knew it was you. I had these... His gaze shoots straight into me. These feelings for you. Such incredibly strong feelings. I still have them now. I knew that I needed you to understand something, that there was a chance you might not, but I couldn't remember what it was I was supposed to tell you. I knew that I had done something terrible. I had this guilt, but I didn't know what it was I'd done. I saw you that first day. I tried so hard to remember what I needed to say, and you ran to me, and all I could do was call you by your name. And when I woke up later, you'd gone, but I remembered. I remembered who you were. What had happened to you, to Marnie, all those years ago. The memories of that night were so fresh in my mind. Your fingers burnt, somehow, on a firework, I think, I don't know. They were bandaged. I remembered your house, full of gas, poison in the air, and a body, blood everywhere. What was done to you? I felt certain that it must have been me who had done those things to you. I couldn't bear that I'd hurt you. I didn't do it to trick you, Emma, I promise. I would never trick you. I thought I did what your father did. But now I see, I only remembered the details of that night because I tried so hard to find you. Because I care so much about you. He pauses. Unsure if he should say what he was planning to say next. I didn't mean to trick you, but if I'm honest, I think that's why he chose to come here. He wanted to use your father as a way in. He? I ask, leaning forward quickly in my chair. Yes, all of this to get me to you. Who is he, Matthew? He pauses, a frown crinkling his brow that then gives way to a look of genuine surprise. Oh no, I'm so sorry, Emma. I didn't mean to. There is no one else. It was a turn of phrase. He, me, Stephen. Whoever I was before the beach. He watches as the sense of what he's saying sinks in, and I lean back defeated. Now it is his turn to ask me a question. You thought I meant your father, didn't you? I feel the rush of blood to my face, to my head. Shame. He knows my shame. He knows how stupid I am. Matthew continues, but I'm barely listening. I'm sorry. I think he wanted you off center. That's why he brought you back here. And it seems like it worked. Easier if he separated you from the people you trust, from your everyday life. Easier for me to get close. But I promise you, Emma, when I said those things in the hospital, I thought they were real. I wasn't trying to trick you. I truly thought I had been the one who hurt you, and I was beyond sorry. I feel exposed, raw, and unprotected. How is it so easy to break me down, to strip me back? After the years of therapy since it happened, after all my training, I try to make sense of the man before me, my persecutor and my savior. How did you know those things about me, Matthew? They were private. Who told them to you? There must have been someone else. How did you know those things about Rhoda? I didn't know how I knew those things at the time, about Rhoda, about you. I just saw people's faces in the hospital and memories would come, information about them. Rhoda in the park, your house, blood on the floorboards, your burnt fingers. Later, I remembered I'd left something in the hospital garden, a phone. The phone sent me here, to Lillian's house. I found I knew where to find the key. I found research here, a note explaining everything. He points back towards the shadows of the bedroom doorway. There's months worth of information on you, your past, your job in London, your life, your flat, on Rhoda and everyone I might have come into contact with at the hospital. Facts on everyone I might need to form some kind of relationship with. So when I first saw Rhoda, I knew what she'd been through, what she needed. And I waited for you to arrive. And then when I came here 3 nights ago, I realized why I needed you. He leans forward in his seat, excitedly. He read your article, Emma. I read your article. The one about misdiagnosis, few cases. It was me you wrote about in that paper. You didn't know then that you were, and you didn't recognize me when you finally saw me, but your paper was about my case. I read it, and in it, you believed me. You believed my case, that it was real, that I was telling the truth. Everyone else thought I was lying, faking symptoms, and only you believed me, Dr. Lewis. Granted, you wrote your article years after my case, years after that first incident, but you believed me. You said in the article that you would have treated me, my case, differently. Do you remember? Do you remember saying that? You wrote about the unknown male case. I was hospitalized in Buffalo, New York. I knew, we knew, we had to come and find you, so you could fix us. Fix this. I knew you'd be the only one who could. Oh my God. My mind whirs as I try and process what he's saying. But the unknown young male case was years ago. My eyes flash across his face, his handsome features, his cheeks sprinkled with graying stubble, his tousled hair silvered at its edges. He looks so different from that picture taken 2 decades ago. Older, more muscular, not like the skinny young man in that grainy photograph, not like the man I would have imagined he'd grow into. But those eyes. I inhale sharply. I see it now. That same oddly calm gaze, as if he was somehow outside of life, looking in. A spectator. It is him. All this time, and I had no idea. How could I have missed it? But there were signs. My God, there were signs. I recall the first instinct I had when Peter showed me Matthew's brain scan. That day in the Wellcome Collection Museum, Matthew's pituitary cyst, the thing that really sparked my interest in the case. The symptom that reminded me of other Fugue patients I'd seen. But Matthew's cyst wasn't a shared symptom among several Fugue patients. It was just his symptom. I had been looking at a scan of the same brain, the same patient 20 years apart. "That was over 20 years ago," he continues. "I was in my 20s when I first stumbled into that hospital in New York. Two black eyes, a shaved head, and no memory of who I was. Richard Groves was my consulting neuropsychiatrist." "Of course, it was Groves' case." "Wait, Matthew," I blurt. "Are you saying Dr. Groves knew who you were? He sent you to me?" My brain scrambles desperately, trying to piece things together. Could Groves really do something like this to me? I can't believe he would knowingly endanger me. Matthew shakes his head. "No. Groves would have ruined everything. That's the last thing I would have wanted. I needed to make sure Groves wouldn't come. I knew they'd call him first, so I had to wait until I knew he'd be too busy to take this case himself. I did my research. I waited until he was right in the heart of something far more high profile. I know the sort of man Dr. Groves is, trust me. That's why I chose to come here, to the coast, instead of London. I knew Groves wouldn't come here for this. This isn't a big enough draw. Not me, not this nowhere hospital. He's at MIT right now. I waited until he was right in the thick of it. His AI research project. I knew he'd call you. You'd be his obvious choice. I made sure you would be. I made sure a few of your colleagues were unavailable. I made sure the job fell to you.